It's time to take a look at what Texas's political parties are planning for the year 2020, a sneak peek to their strategies, today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
With heavy hearts, we bring you the latest on the shooting at a house of worship in White Settlement, Texas. What if what was once a symbol of hatred could be transformed into a symbol of unity? The arts organization that's trying to do just that. Some numbers at the Texas Department of Criminal Justice are not adding up. How did TDCJ so drastically reduce the number of attempted suicides? And the poetry of a young Syrian boy. That's next on the Texas Standard. 2019 will go down in history as the year with the most mass killings in the United States since the 1970s. This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown on this, the last Monday of the year. A team of three, the Associated Press, USA Today, and Northeastern University are the groups that tallied the numbers. 41 mass killings left a jarring scar on the last year of the decade. Not all of the killings were shootings, but El Paso stands out as one of the most prominent. Now there's this, not a mass killing, but the heart of many Texans are heavy yet again as the year ends. There was another deadly shooting in a public space, what for some is a sacred space, a house of worship. Here's what we know about the shooting at a church in White Settlement, Texas, a community about 15 minutes west of Fort Worth. Three people are dead, including the person that opened fire on church members while the worship was ongoing yesterday morning. Law enforcement say the church has a volunteer security team. Two people for that team had guns and returned fire, killing the shooter. The church's senior pastor, Britt Farmer, was in mourning yesterday as he addressed members of the press. He was clearly moved about the loss of his church members, but credited them with protecting the congregation.
We lost two great men today, but it could have been a lot worse. And I'm thankful that our government has allowed us the opportunity to protect ourselves. We have a congregation here of open-hearted people. We help people. We're here to help people. And to have something like this happen destroys my heart.
The shooting has reopened the debate among top Texas lawmakers about gun rights and protection. While expressing his grief for the people killed in yesterday's shooting and those affected by their deaths, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, too, praised those who returned fire on the shooter.
Two of the parishioners who are volunteers on the security force drew their weapons and took out the killer immediately, saving untold number of lives.
In a statement released by the Lieutenant Governor's office, Patrick credited a bill passed by lawmakers last legislative session in response to the deadly church shooting in Sutherland Springs in 2017. The measure allows those who have a license to carry a concealed gun to carry in places of worship for self-defense. Patrick also highlighted a measure cleared through the legislature two sessions ago, which kept churches from having to pay state fees to form their own security forces. Governor Greg Abbott said the shooting is a horrible tragedy and that he's grateful for the people who acted quickly to take down the shooter. We'll be checking in with reporter Chris Connolly from our partner station KERA in North Texas later in the program for the latest updates on the White Settlement Church shooting. Looking at the year that was, politically, 2019 was busy to say the least, but we're not going too far out on a limb by saying that 2020 will be even busier with a presidential election and all. So, we thought that this would be a good opportunity to check in with Texas's Republican and Democratic parties about what's happened in their respective camps over the past year and what's to come. We will start with a conversation Texas Standard host David Brown recorded with James Dickey. He's the Texas Republican Party chair, and later in the show, we'll hear from his counterpart in the Democratic Party. First, Brown and Dickey.
I have to ask you now, I mean, because some people would say one thing, some people would say another. What do you consider to be the top story for the Republicans in 2019?
I think the top story for Republicans in 2019 is that the Texas economy once again boomed because of Republican leadership, that we have shown for 15 amazing years in a row that thanks to Republican leadership and thanks to Republican policies, every single Texan's life is better than it would have been without it.
Now, you know what? I bet a lot of newspaper editors would say that the top story for Texas Republicans in 2019 might have involved a certain House Speaker. I mean, how do you think that whole issue that went down with Dennis Bonin offering media passes to conservative activist Michael Quinn Sullivan, how do you think that was read by the electorate? Or was it? Do you think it made any difference to them?
Well, obviously, the whole incident is unfortunate, but as for how it impacts the average Texas voter or average Texas constituent on a day-to-day basis, and the answer is pretty clear that it doesn't. What impacts the average Texan is the amazing Republican policies that have been enacted by Republican leadership over the last 16 years.
Point taken. I understand what you're saying, because the inner workings of politics often that doesn't seem to register with a lot of voters. But what does it do to trust and cohesiveness within the party? Has that been an issue that you've had to deal with?
Well, we have, fortunately, a lot of amazing Republican elected officials and activists. So we've got everybody working together to make sure that in 2020 we continue the string of victories and the string of policies that have led to the best potential for all Texans.
Is that what it takes, working together? I mean, in that conversation, that taped conversation that ultimately led to Speaker Bonin's ouster, he said the president is, quote, killing us in urban suburban districts. And, you know, the narrative as we're looking at 2020, there are a lot of Republicans Texas Republicans, even at the national level, who are saying no longer can Republican candidates take things for granted. We're not necessarily the red state that we once were. What do you make of that assessment?
Well, for 2.5 years, I've been reminding people that no one succeeds. No elected official succeeds by taking voters for granted. Mm-hmm. And anyone who understands and appreciates history knows that Texas was never as blood red as people liked to assume on both sides. I mean, don't forget, we've only had control of the Texas House for 16 years. 2003 was the very first year the Texas House became majority Republican. So the people who acted like they could and should be able to phone it in were always, in my mind, not evaluating things properly, nor acting with the amount of respect for voters that they should. But the bottom line is Republicans are working now at the level that Democrats in Texas have been working for a while. The difference is that now Republicans have awakened and we are on the offense. We have gone after Democrat strongholds, and it is starting to pay off. I mean, last year we were able to win back a Texas Senate seat that had been in the hands of Democrats for 139 years. Mm-hmm. That is a first step among many that we intend to take.
The conventional wisdom, and of course that's, you say what you will about conventional wisdom, but you talk to some of the political wags here in Texas and they will tell you that right now it looks like the Democrats are, you know, they could take the Texas House in 2020, and they look back at 2018.
Sorry.
No, I'd love to know why you think that's not. It sounds like you don't think that's accurate.
Yeah. So to do that, they would have to hold on to all 12 of the 12 House seats that they won and win 9 more seats. And the reality is that they are not going to win. They're not going to win all of the next 9 seats, nor are they going to retain all 12 of the other seats. I mean, as I point to the difference in the amount of work last time, I mean, two of the 12 seats that they won, you know, in one of them, the incumbent had $130,000 in the bank on election night. And yet lost that seat by less than 2 points. There was another candidate who lost by less than 3% and who had spent the last few weeks of the election not campaigning in his own district, but in another. Well, that kind of, you know, failure to take the need to earn the vote seriously, and that kind of candidacy where the voter is taken for granted, that's just simply not going to happen this time.
Impeachment, does that move the needle?
It should. It should move the needle in our favor. It was such an egregious overreach, and I mean, for the House to almost simultaneously impeach the president for obstruction of the House, which is an interesting interpretation of the separation of powers between the different branches of our government, and then to try to dictate to the Senate how it should operate. The hypocrisy is so clear cut, and the vengeance on the voters for daring to not go with their coronated chosen candidate in 2016 is really striking and revealing.
So on November 4th, 2020, day after Election Day, what do you think the headline's going to be in papers across Texas?
The headline's going to be that Texas can look forward to at least two more years of really successful Republican leadership across Texas.
No, none of this purple state stuff for you, it sounds like.
Well, it is always a possibility unless we do the work we must. But if I'm betting on who is willing to do the hard work, I'm betting on the Republicans every time.
James Dickey is chairman of the Republican Party of Texas. Mr. Dickey, pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and Happy Holidays to you.
Very Merry Christmas to you and yours too.
We have a treat. Web editor Shelley Brisbane is here for social media editor Wells Dunbar. Shelley, what are Texans talking about today?
Hey there, Joy. Well, we were talking to leaders of the Democratic and Republican Party today, but I wanted to find out what listeners have on their minds, what they want candidates and politicians to focus on in 2020. And Rick Chafee says property tax relief.
Oh.
And Larry Richard says someone needs to focus on term limits and single issue bills or we won't have proper representation. We had a couple people say legalization of marijuana and affordable housing was another issue that was important. I'll be back at the end of the show with some reaction to the shooting yesterday in White Settlement, Texas.
So join the conversation on Facebook, on Twitter.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. On today's show, we've been taking stock off the year that was, and we've been looking ahead to the year that will be from a political perspective. You may remember that earlier on the show, we heard a conversation between host David Brown and James Dickey, the chair of the Republican Party of Texas. Well, now we'll hear from Dickey's counterpart, Gilberto Hinojosa. Hinojosa is chairman of the Democratic Party of Texas, and here he is speaking with David Brown.
Are you disappointed that Julian Castro and Beto O'Rourke chose to run for president rather than, say, some other office or perhaps even keeping their powder dry for a possible seat in state politics for a couple of years? What do you make of the political capital spent by both of those very prominent Texas Democrats?
Well, I mean, I think that they made a decision based upon what they thought was best for not just themselves, but for our country and for our state. And, you know, it's not something that, you know, someone who is not the person making that decision can second guess.
Really, can you not say, you're head of the Texas Democratic Party, and I'm sure you must have thought, well, was this good for the Texas Democrats? Surely you must have thought that through.
Well, no, I mean, obviously we have always believed that both Beto and Julian are individuals that can win a statewide race in Texas. But the decision on whether or not to undertake a national campaign for president is a really personal decision based upon a lot of different factors that only they can make. And so both of these individuals are outstanding public servants, and they will continue to be in the game. Maybe not as candidates this time around, but they will be in the game as people that are participating to ensure that Democrats are elected in this state at every position. I just heard today that Beto, for example, has started an organization where he will help us flip the House and raising money and getting activists to be involved in that effort, which the Democratic Party has made its number one priority this next election cycle.
Well, you talk about flipping the House. This has been a turbulent year for Texas Republicans, given the scandal surrounding Empower Texas Texans and Speaker Dennis Bonin exchanging media access for targeting state House Republicans. How are the Texas Democrats going to capitalize on that, given that, to a lot of folks, that's sort of inside baseball, that whole Dennis Bonin fiasco?
Well, it's not so much capitalizing on their mistakes as it is that they have been placed at a disadvantage that they did not think they had prior to this scandal. I mean, we're proceeding forward the same way we were proceeding prior to the time that this scandal erupted in the Republican Party. But obviously, it helps us that the Republicans are in disarray, that they're fighting each other, that their top leader that would have been their top fundraiser is out of commission now.
But if Democrats do make those gains, why will that have been the case? What is it that has changed about Texas politics after years and years of people considering Texas the reddest of red states?
Well, a lot of things have changed. Obviously, this is not the same Democratic Party as before. I mean, we're much better organized, much better funded. But there's also something that is happening today that a lot of people didn't expect. For example, in the House seats that we've been picking up and that we expect to pick up, when the Republicans did redistricting and gerrymandered the House districts in Texas, they sliced them up kind of thin because they got greedy. And so over time, those districts were not as reliably red as they had when they gerrymandered them, when they did the redistricting. And so what happened is that you had, you know, Latino populations beginning to become engaged, registered, and starting to vote. Large influx of Asian Americans as well has affected a lot of these House seats. And there's been a big migration of people from the East Coast and the West Coast that have come into Texas, particularly in a lot of the suburbs. And then the final factor is Donald Trump. You know, he's, for Texas Democrats, the gift that keeps on giving.
Forgive me for framing it this way, but what I hear you saying is basically two things. The technicals, the demographics, that sort of thing are in our favor. And second, we're not the Republicans. But what I don't hear you saying is what Texas Democrats are, affirmatively. What is a Texas Democrat? And I'm not hearing a whole lot of that message overall. I mean, what is it that Texans would be pulling the lever for?
Well, and I think that's the reason why you saw us pick up 12 seats is because of the message that our candidates have been bringing to the voters. I mean, on the one side, the Republican Party, they're preaching, you know, large tax cuts for the wealthy, gutting public education, and eliminating the Affordable Care Act. And that's a negative factor for them because voters in the state of Texas are not with them on those issues.
True, but what are Texas Democrats
have
promising?
Been preaching, talking about has been expanding the access to health care for all Texans. Democrats are advocating for a stronger public education system and adequately funding public education. Access to higher education, Democrats are talking about and working towards ensuring that every Texan that wants to go to college has the ability to do that. We believe that that climate change is a significant problem affecting the future of the world, not just Texas and the United States, but the world. These are all things that we are advocating to the voters all across the state of Texas. These are all issues. These are part of the campaigns. These are the policy positions that we are taking to the voters, and the voters are saying, yeah, we believe in that.
So, Mr. Hinojosa, on November 4th, 2020, the day after Election Day, what do you think the headline is going to be in papers across Texas?
Well, I think the first headline, it's got to be Trump gets defeated by a landslide. That's the first headline that I'd like to see. And the second headline is going to be that the Texas House of Representatives is now run by Democrats, and they'll be electing a speaker. And we have a brand new United States Senator representing the state of Texas who's a Democrat.
Gilberto Hinojosa is chair of the Texas Democratic Party. Mr. Hinojosa, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. It's a pleasure to get to say hello.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Gas prices jumped up last week, but the Houston Chronicle reports that doesn't mean they'll keep rising. Drivers are paying up to $2.19 for a gallon of regular unleaded gas. Recent declines in U.S. petroleum inventories have given both oil and fuel prices a boost in the last week after weeks of crude production cuts anticipated for early 2020. Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis for GasBody.com, says a fall in demand is likely to happen in January and February, and that could weaken any pricing surge. You know that the rise in pricing starts in March or April.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A retired Fort Worth pastor is recalling how a shooting affected his own church 20 years ago. Al Meredith was senior pastor of Wedgwood Baptist Church in 1999 when a 47-year-old man opened fire, killing seven people before killing himself. That congregation is located about 10 miles from West Freeway Church of Christ, where a gunman killed two people Sunday before he was fatally shot by parishioners. Meredith tells KERA News, while the volunteer members of the church's security team probably prevented more bloodshed, it does make him nervous.
It could easily become a shootout at the OK Corral. That's just the times we live in.
Meredith says he's praying for the members of the West Freeway Church of Christ in White Settlement. U.S. Senator Ted Cruz says he would like to see witnesses testify in President Trump's impeachment trial that could begin early next year. The Texas Republican told Fox News Channel on Sunday both parties should be allowed to present their cases regarding allegations of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. But he said the Senate proceedings will be different than impeachment hearings held in the House.
So you're not going to see Elizabeth Warren and me going 15 rounds on the Senate floor, because that's not allowed. We're both going to be sitting quietly in our desks. Now, we can submit questions, but the questions have to be in writing. And so we can write out the question, and we hand them down, and the Chief Justice asks the questions from the senators.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has been resistant to calls from Democrats to include witnesses in a trial. An advocate for survivors of domestic violence is praising a partnership between the Bexar County Sheriff's Office and the San Antonio Police Department to get high-tech doorbells to people at risk of being attacked. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie has more.
The doorbells have high-def cameras and motion detectors, and they film anyone who approaches a house. They were given to law enforcement by the company Ring. The sheriff and the police chief, in turn, decided to give them to victims of domestic violence who were at high risk of being stalked, harassed, or further harmed by their abusers. Patricia Castillo is executive director of the Peace Initiative, and she says these doorbells could discourage violence.
Making them think twice before they come and try to tear your door down if they know that they're being videotaped while doing it.
Castillo noted that lower-income families, though, may not be able to use the free doorbells because Ring is a subscription service and it requires Wi-Fi, two things these families may not be able to afford. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
Texas factory activity picked up in December after a slowdown last month. That's according to the monthly manufacturing survey from the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. Picture this. Over the past year, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, or TDCJ, recorded a very similar number every month of suicide attempts. And what I mean when I say very similar number is that on average, there were 167 suicide attempts every month. But in September, something happened. The number went from 167 to 23. Then in October, that 167 turned into 12. Carrie Blakinger with the Houston Chronicle needed to know what was going on. The answer? TDCJ told her it was overcounting suicide attempts. Carrie Blakinger is with us. Carrie, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
What does that mean, Carrie? How can TDCJ say that they were overcounting suicide attempts?
Well, under their previous definition, they were broadly counting sort of any suicidal ideation. They were essentially counting it based on what the guards were responding to. So if an officer was called to someone's cell to respond to a suicide attempt, that didn't necessarily reflect that that's what was actually happening when they got to the scene. And it didn't actually necessarily reflect that that was what mental health professionals felt had happened.
But how can there be confusion? I mean, if somebody says, get the guards, there's a suicide attempt. Isn't that a suicide attempt?
I mean, in theory, you know, it could have been that a cellmate was calling the guards and saying, hey, this guy wants to kill himself. And then they show up and he's, you know, not actually actively attempting to, but is simply experiencing suicidal ideation, which is, of course, distinct from a suicide attempt. I mean, and this is sort of, this is the narrative we've been told, that they were counting sort of general statements of intent and not actually attempts.
I see. Because of the medical definition, right? That's what they're telling you they're going by now.
That is what they're saying. You know, the thing is, I don't have great confidence in either number, either the 12 or the 167.
Why is that?
Because when I was sort of just Googling around and looking at what is the standard in terms of how many suicide attempts are actually completed, and it seems like that 12 number would be really low.
Very low.
There were 40 actual suicides last year in Texas prisons. And in their latest data, it said that there were an average of like 3 a month. So if there's an average of 3 a month and 12 attempts a month, that would be a really high completion rate. Mm. Now, I don't know how that stacks up in prison. Would you expect a different completion rate than in the free world? I don't know. I think, you know, just on its face, even without looking at the data, that would seem like a really high completion rate.
Hmm.
I think that it would seem like there's some indicators that 12 number could be low. And, you know, I think it's possible that that 167 number was high because that number had actually been year over year climbing significantly. I mean, a few years ago, it had been something like, you know, less than half that, like 4 or 5 years ago. At the time, they said that was because they were collecting data differently.
Mm-hmm.
and that they'd broaden their definition of suicide attempt. And that's why the numbers had gone up for like 5 years.
Right.
And then I wrote about it. And a few months later, they change it and narrow their definition. So it's just, it's troubling in that it's hard to in any way meaningfully track what's going on.
I'd really like to understand if the lower number means that TDCJ is doing everything it can to prevent suicide attempts, or if it's simply doing everything it can to appear as though suicide attempts are all of the sudden fewer.
I mean, I think there's some chance that this lower number could be in some ways a more meaningful metric, even though I don't think it's accurate either. I do think overcounting them as they apparently were doing before is problematic. From the stories I have written for the past, 3 years, and from just the anecdotes I hear on a daily basis, I don't think TDCJ is doing everything it can in regards to healthcare or mental health care in any capacity. You know, I mean, that's just almost a given. And part of this is understaffing. I mean, they're doing, the last report I saw, they were doing better at some of the facilities. But, you know, some of these facilities are also quite understaffed. And, you know, the agency has made efforts to deal with that. But it's going to be hard to, you know, adequately supervise a suicidal prisoner when you simply don't have enough staff at some of these units.
Carrie Blakinger covers breaking news, prisons, and the death penalty for the Houston Chronicle. Carrie, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network of physicians treating more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year with technology and cancer-fighting care options. More at texasoncology.com.
I am Ajit Kapoor, and this is my poem called Where I'm From. I am from pomegranate trees, from big juicy peaches and sweet grapes growing on vines that cover the roof of our house, from the smell of fresh lemons on the trees near the pond that has a fountain. I am from a farming community where large families share what they grow. I'm from steamy black tea, fresh baked bread, and the smell of coffee in the morning. From my family eating breakfast outdoors in the cold air. I am from harsh rain hitting the windows and the scent of jasmine in my grandmother's courtyard. I am from the sounds and smells of celebrating Eid. From jingling coins and giggling kids. From the aroma of spicy hot barbecue and fresh date cookies my cousins and I ate at my grandmother's house. I am from the smell of strong cologne and cigars in my parents' room, where everything was neat, from the butter-flavored candy hidden there. My name is Majid Kapoor, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Minutes past the hour. It's Texas Standard Time, and I'm Joy Diaz. It may be the last meeting hall built by the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s that's still standing, and it's in Texas, in Fort Worth. The building is decrepit and the current owner wants to demolish it. But as KRA's Jerome Weeks reports, an arts group wants to preserve the building and upend its racist origins.
The old four-story building is a hulk and stands across the Trinity River from downtown Fort Worth. This North Side neighborhood has been home to African Americans and Latinos for generations. So the decision by the Ku Klux Klan in 1924 to build its meeting hall here seems deliberate.
Most of the old Klan halls were little storefronts, and this building was built for all of God and humanity to see, and they're very proud of it.
Fort Worth historian Richard Seltzer stands in front of the hall with its tall, arched windows like a church. And behind that, it's just a big, crumbling red brick warehouse adapted as an auditorium. Seltzer estimates it could hold 2,000 people. The hall was the public face of the Klan. It was used for business meetings and social events. There were lynchings in Fort Worth, but Seltzer says he's found no evidence they happened here. Instead, the hall was rented out. The St. Louis Symphony Orchestra played here. All this, Seltzer says, shows the Klan was not just some bunch of backwoods vigilantes with a rope.
To build this, to raise the money by subscription, to put it right up there over the doorway, Ku Klux Klan Hall, tells you that they weren't hiding in the shadows. These people weren't afraid.
In July, the hall's owner, a limited liability company called Sugar Plum Holdings, filed for permission from the city's Historic and Cultural Landmarks Commission to demolish it. Murray Miller is Fort Worth's Historic Preservation Officer.
The Landmarks Commission cannot deny the request. What they can do is they can delay it for up to 180 days. The Landmarks Commission and local preservation groups and other interested parties can explore alternatives to demolition.
That delay runs out January 4th. Two people working to save the hall, Daniel Banks and Adam McKinney, both of whom are Black. They're co-founders of a small nonprofit called DNA Works. It uses the arts for healing, identity, and social justice. Preservationists wish to restore the hall. Banks and McKinney have other ideas. They want to use it to counter racial hatred by making it a multicultural arts venue, education center, and more. Adam McKinney.
There will be performances, there will be exhibits. We also have been talking about a farmer's market and an artisan's market, thinking about the ways in which we can support several neighborhoods in Fort Worth.
McKinney is a dance professor at Texas Christian University. McKinney and Banks are co-directors of DNA Works. They're aware their plans are ambitious. That demolition request included an engineer's report saying it would cost $8 to $10 million just to bring the hall up to code. Sugar Plum Holdings declined to comment. DNA Works has its own numbers. Daniel Banks.
In order to purchase and stabilize the property, we're looking at approximately $4 million.
That's just stabilizing it. For everything else, the final cost gets closer to $20 million. The numbers don't faze McKinney. He and Banks have been canvassing philanthropic groups and patrons.
I think it will cost us more not to transform that building into something that will move us together as a community.
Many Fort Worth residents had no idea they might have the last standing Klan-bought, Klan-built meeting hall in America. That's partly because the Klan owned it for only 2 years. But City Council member Carlos Flores says, even as a boy, he knew what the hall stood for. He's Latino and Catholic, both communities targeted by the Klan. Flores represents District 2, where the hall is located.
3 generations of my family live there in the North Side. A lot of the longtime folks that live in the North Side knew about the building's past.
DNA Works' plan for the hall could benefit the neighborhood. Flores has publicly supported it with 4 other council members, although the council has no say in the hall's fate.
Yes, we belong to the Ku Klux Klan. We belong to the Ku Klux Klan.
In 1924, when the hall opened, the Klan had a more public, even popular presence, and not just in the South.
The Klan actually achieved respectability.
NYU history professor Linda Gordon wrote the book The Second Coming of the KKK. She says the original Klan eventually dissolved after the Civil War because it had effectively established Jim Crow segregation. But in the 20s, the Klan was reinvented as a money-making, fraternal organization, and political power. Under leader Hiram Evans, a former Dallas dentist, the Klan gained millions of members nationwide.
It was a very wealthy organization. It operated 150-some newspapers, and this is not counting all the money accrued by its very, very corrupt top leadership.
The Klan was revived partly because it was the Roaring Twenties. Bootleggers, Catholic and Jewish immigrants, Black Americans migrating to the cities. All this, many white Americans feared as immoral and destabilizing. And the Klan responded with bloodshed, but also with popular appeals to what it called 100% Americanism. Historian Richard Seltzer says Klan members did not terrorize just minorities. They enforced what they saw as the public good.
They're protectors of morality and of patriotism. And if that means whipping some wife beater drunk, then that's not terrorism, that's protecting family and motherhood.
By the late 30s, the National Klan went bankrupt from financial scandals. Today, Daniel Banks says the hall's owner, Sugar Plum Holdings, has been open to discussions. But Banks is realistic.
The clearest path would be to have, say, a commercial real estate developer make an offer to the owners on the building and then allow our leadership coalition to be the stewards.
Adam McKinney says, as a Black man, he's aware people may find preserving the Klan Hall hurtful. but he's not trying to preserve it. The building has a kind of power, he says, and he wants to use that.
It's important to stand in the building to feel the energy in that space. We hope that people will enter the building and leave changed.
Richard Seltzer says, imagine the impact bringing school kids into the hall, to have them stand where the Klan once stood, look at what the Klan once built. He asks, if a picture's worth a thousand words, what's a building worth? In Fort Worth, I'm Jerome Weeks for the Texas Standard.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. We don't know much, but details are starting to trickle out today regarding Sunday's tragic shooting inside a church west of Fort Worth. Two members of the West Freeway Church of Christ in White Settlement were shot and killed, but the gunman himself was killed by an armed volunteer security team inside the church. Here to update us is Christopher Connolly. He's a reporter for Dallas-based KERA. Chris, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, Joy.
I know that we don't know much, but we do know that the FBI described the shooter as relatively transient. We also know that he had an extensive arrest record. We know he had roots in North Texas, but we don't know his name, for instance. Do you know anything else about this man?
You're right. The police have not named the shooter. His name is not out yet. But like you said, he is said to be transient, to have some roots in the area. Law enforcement officials last night said that he had an extensive arrest record, but they really didn't offer any details about what sorts of crimes he was arrested for or whether he had been convicted of them. We do know that the Department of the Texas Department of Public Safety is leading the investigation, and they're working hand in glove with federal and local law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Officials said last night that they still didn't know what led the shooter to bring a gun to the church and open fire.
Mm.
And law enforcement officials said they don't know if there was any ideology at work.
Do we even know if he was a member of the church or if he had a new relationship to the victims or anything?
We do not. One woman from the church, one parishioner from the church, told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that she remembers thinking that he seemed odd. That seemed to be based on his appearance. He seemed to have a fake beard or fake hair, and was sort of sitting in the back. But it was clear that she didn't recognize him. But it's not clear what his relationship, if any, with this particular church may have been.
So two people were killed, and police have not named them yet, but the daughter of one of the victims, 64-year-old Tony Wallace, told reporters that he was one of the people who was shot and killed, and she told reporters that he was a deacon in the church and that he was handing out communion when he was shot. What else do we know?
Right. Other than the daughter telling the local NPC affiliate that Tony Wallace, her father, a 64-year-old man, was killed in the shooting. We know that the other victim was a member of the security team. His name hasn't been released yet.
It is not unusual in Texas for people to carry guns in a church, but it is probably a detail that is different for the rest of the country when they hear that the shooter was shot inside the church by members of the church. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Texas legislature did to allow this to happen?
Well, in 2017, the legislature passed a law that exempted churches from fees that have to be paid to have an armed security personnel. Those fees were exempted for churches so that they could have their own security teams, armed security teams. And then in 2019, the law was clarified to make it clear that people with concealed carry permits can bring their weapons into a church unless the church explicitly bans it. And that followed just a couple years after the attack in Sutherland Springs, Texas, that left many people dead.
Do we know anything about why this church in particular had an armed security team?
It is not entirely clear, but last night, the pastor of the church, Britt Farmer, he said that they lost two great men, but it could have been so much worse. He said he wants the church to stand as a beacon for the idea that not only can we, this is a quote, not only can we be God-loving, God-fearing people, but we can protect each other too.
Chris, thank you for your reporting.
Sure thing.
Christopher Connolly is a reporter for KRA in Dallas. He brought us the latest on this shooting. And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Shelley Brisbane, welcome back. She's our web editor with The Talk of Texas, and she's in for social media editor Wells Dunbar. Please, Shelley, tell us what Texans are talking about.
Hey there, Joy. Texans are talking about the shooting that you and Chris Connolly just talked about, and they have a lot of thoughts and feelings that don't necessarily agree with one another, which is often the case in shootings, and they're concerned about the reactions of politicians as well as gun policy and gun rights. And Kim L. Egli Najera says, is there truly no safe place, is there truly no sacred place where people worship used to be, in most cases, considered off limits or a sanctuary? Mm. Tanya Sampson says she's grateful that the tragic event was contained and that the people were able to end the shooting, but she's concerned that there's a problem when good guys and bad guys end up shooting it out in a house of worship. Mm. Richard Elizabeth says that he sees it's not too soon for Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor, to talk about guns when the circumstances in this particular political agenda. He says, let's not focus on the innocent people who died. And there were a couple of others who were concerned that some politicians they felt like were using this situation for their advantage. And other people disagree. Other people say, for example, Samuel David Holbrook says, you can't fix this stuff other than the way it was handled, and we'll never have a bulletproof society. I have never known these men, and he's talking about Senators Cruz and Cornyn, especially Cruz, to accept only thoughts and prayers. So some disagreement about that.
You know, when you said that there was disagreement about what people are talking about, it is so Texas, right? I mean, we disagree, we push, we pull, and that is one of the things that makes this state such a wonderful place to be. But it is true, one thing that we cannot disagree with is the numbers. And, you know, it really touches me when I see that this was the worst year for mass killings, for instance. And it makes me reflect. Let's say that. It makes me reflect. 41 mass killings.
Yes, that's a lot of people who lost their lives. And sadly, some of them lost their lives in places like churches where they absolutely thought that they were safe and were protected. And there are some on our Facebook page who want to commend the people who took down the gunman, the people in the congregation who were part of the security committee. And there are others who believe that having guns, as I think a commenter I read earlier said, is not a good way. Shootouts between good guys and bad guys. So different people have different approaches, but definitely everyone mourns the loss of those folks in
the
church.
Yeah, one of the headlines was, you know, a shooting in Texas was over in 6 seconds. And you have to agree with the pastor that more lives could have been lost. It could have been another mass shooting. And then you also understand the people who say, you know, guns should not be in a place of worship. It's just, you know, so heart-wrenching and so complicated, and the loss of any life is
difficult.
It's very difficult, absolutely. And there is a conversation going on Facebook and Twitter right now, so please join in. We'd love to hear what you have to say about this topic or any of the things that we've been discussing on the show today.
And if you're not on social media, write to us. We read your emails. We read your letters. Email us at texasstandard@kut.org. On behalf of David Brown and everybody under Standard, I'm Joy Diaz.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.